I made it to Madison last night. I'm going to make some observations about Madison. Are you ready for them?
Yeah.
It's cold. That's it. No, the other one is there are a lot of Teslas in Madison, Wisconsin. I don't know why I noticed that, but I was like, do you have to buy a Tesla to like live in Madison, Wisconsin? Because it feels like I see more here than anywhere else. So I drove last night. Thank you for having me. Just a little bit on my background. I have a PhD in political science from I teach Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, Illinois, which is way far south in the state. I grew up in a little town called Salem, Illinois, which is a town of 8,000 people. We are the birthplace of William Jennings Bryan. Do you guys know who that is?
Yeah.
Yeah, William Jennings, the great commoner, ran for president 3 times, lost 3 times. Also the home of Miracle Whip, which was sold to Kraft for $500. And no royalty. Let us all be reminded of the business lesson. Always take a royalty. And actually, the GI Bill of Rights was signed in Salem, Illinois, oddly enough. So there's a weird piece of history. I went to SIU Carbondale. I've got a PhD there in 2011. And now I teach at Eastern Illinois University, which is in Charleston, Illinois, which is just south of Champaign. I still live in Mount Vernon. My wife and I started dating when I was 19 and she was 17. We went to high school together. We got married in 2007. We have 2 boys. Holden's 12 and Reed is 8. Holden's playing travel baseball today. And I told him, don't get hit in the face. That's always my advice for him, is don't get hit in the face. I am a pastor of an American Baptist church. I grew up Southern Baptist in a little church called First Baptist Church in Salem, Illinois. Got baptized at 15 years old. And then I went to Greenville College, which is a free Methodist school, and I came out a mainline Protestant somehow. Started at ABC USA when I was 20 as a youth pastor. I really took the job in ministry because I needed a job, not because I didn't have that Isaiah 6 moment, right, where it's like, here I am, Lord, send me. It was like, no, I need money, and they'll pay me, so let's go. It was supposed to be a 3-month internship, a summer internship, and it turned into 3 years there. And then when I went to grad school, my first year there, I worked at a little church called Warner Street Baptist Church. Everyone there was 75 and older, and I was 23. I owned 1 suit. They wanted me to preach in a suit every Sunday. That suit didn't last very long. Luckily, one got older guy in the congregation came up to me at one point, put a $100 bill in my hand, go buy a new suit. And I did. So I was there for a year, left there because I got a graduate assistantship at SIU, which is like a job. You know, I thought, okay, I can make that work. And then a church in Mount Vernon, Illinois called me and said, would you come preach on Sunday? I said, sure. And then the next Sunday they called, will you preach this Sunday? I said, sure. And then the next Sunday they called and go, you're interim pastor now, whether you like it or not. And I've been there for 17 years. So I've been there since I was 24 years old. First Baptist Church in Mount Vernon, Illinois, it was founded in 1868, and we will celebrate our last Sunday together in July. We had 8 people in worship last Sunday. So that's part of my story as well. So I tell you all that to contextualize all the things you're going to see, right? So if you hear me say things about the main line, the only grave I'm dancing on is my own here, right? I take no joy in showing you any of these things. I am not a cold, calculated academic. Sometimes I am. This is me, right? So I'm speaking to you both as a social scientist and a pastor, as a Hartford Church, Hartford Ministry, a believer in Jesus Christ, and all those things. So just keep that in mind when you hear all this stuff. You're going to hear me primarily talk about, you know, religion as a social concept, but I also understand it, obviously, as a spiritual concept, too. The title of this is called The Death of Polite Religion and the Future of America. It was just announced in Publishers Weekly this week that I signed a book contract to write this book for Brazos Press, which will come out in spring of 2026. So you're getting a sneak preview. I don't know what's going to end up in the book. I'm starting to write right now, and I'm getting that whole thing, and I have no idea what I'm doing. So hopefully we'll see how things go today. So 2 goals. We're gonna have we're gonna talk for a little bit, and then we're gonna take a break, and then we're gonna talk a little bit more, and we're gonna take a break. There are gonna be questions and answers after each section, though. Okay, so we got plenty of time for all that. First goal today is, what is the current state of the American religious landscape? And two, who is still coming to church on a regular basis, and what are the implications of that? Okay, so broad and then more narrow. Do you like graphs? If you said no, I don't know why you're here right now. I literally don't know how to do this without graphs. I got asked to go give a talk in Chautauqua, the Chautauqua Institute in New York. I'm like, oh, great. That's a really prestigious place. And they go, it's going to be outside. I go, okay, great. There's no screen. I'm like, what do you want me to do for 45 minutes? Like, draw in the air? Like, here's a line, and here's where it goes. So we'll figure it out. Okay, so this is what the American religious landscape looks like from 1972 to 2018. The data after 2018 is a little sketchy, so that's why I didn't put it up here for a whole bunch of reasons. So I'm going to break some of these down in more specificity in just a minute, but I just wanted to kind of give you the broad categorization. Evangelical, obviously, is up here, the blue line, and there's Catholics that kind of like go through there. The biggest story here is this line here. The no religion, right? This purplish line.
Yeah.
And then this line here, which is the main line, which is you and me. Okay? That's the polite religion we're going to talk about a lot today. The religion that I find so compelling is declining rapidly. So we divide Protestant Christianity into three branches, evangelical, mainline, and black Protestant. Black Protestant is its own separate entity. For a whole bunch of cultural and political reasons, they're just in a different category than the white church is. And obviously, there's no right way to do this. This is the way we've done it for a long time. Then Catholics, and then we throw other faith, kind of its own line. That's just like a potpourri of everything that's not on the graph. So everything from Jedis to Wiccans to New Age spiritualists. You want to get weird, look at the free response option on religion. Like, because you get to check a box and you get to write in a box, like with like type things in a box. And I literally think about that. I read one time, this guy goes, well, I'm an atheist, but my wife's Lutheran, and I go to church with her. So what are, like, I don't even know how to classify you using that categorization. One person said they're an ancient alien theorist, which I thought was compelling. But that's the other faith category. Right, so it's a bunch of people who don't fit in traditional religious models, and then the Jewish line down here at the bottom. So let us look at some of these groups in more detail. So let's start with evangelicals. You all know what an evangelical is, right? Or at least you think you do. I don't even know what it is at this point anymore. Evangelicalism is probably the most powerful force in electoral politics today, okay? About 40% of the votes cast for Donald Trump in 2020 were white evangelical votes. There's no more important voting bloc in America than white evangelicalism to the Republicans. And here's what's fascinating about evangelicals, okay? Evangelicals have gone along this weird, like, roller coaster ride over the last 50 years or so. In the early surveys, they started out about 18, 20%. And then you see this, like, weird, like, aberration right here, like this area right there, where they just jumped up really quickly, okay? So really, what, from a numeric perspective, evangelicalism hit its peak in America in 1993 when they were 30% of the population, okay? And from that point forward, it's a decline. But really, the decline, it goes from here to here, and it just kind of like hangs out from that point forward. So I love showing this graph to people because it's like a Rorschach test. Like, what do you see here, you know? Like, some people are like, oh, look, evangelicals are way down from their peak. And they are. But guess what? They're still about the same share of the population today as they were in 1972. There's actually more numerically evangelicals today than there were 50 years ago. So when people say, like, evangelicals, I go, I don't really know if that's true. Like, it's not as clear as people make it out to be. I think evangelicalism is probably as strong today as it was 30 or 40 years ago. And by the way, this graph makes a lot of sense to me because I was born in 1982, grew up in an evangelical church, and guess what? Evangelicalism was the strongest it's ever been when I was in youth group. You know? You look back and go, wow, I grew up in a really weird time. Because evangelicalism is not the same today as it was back when I was a kid. So, this is the bummer graph, guys, and I apologize, but James Baldwin says, not everything that's faced can be changed. Nothing can be changed until it's faced. And so let's face it, right? Mainline Protestant Christianity used to be the most dominant force in American life, okay? In the 1950s, the best estimate is about 52% of all Americans were members in a mainline church, okay? In 1975, it got to 31%. By the way, evangelicals never gotten to 31%, so take that, evangelicals. But as you can see here, we go from a peak of 31% in 1976 to 19% by 1988. So we're talking a 12-point drop in about 12 years. We don't talk about that enough. I want to write a book about that at some point. Like, how did we go from that to that in just a 12-year window of time? And then from this point forward, it's just a slow and steady decline now. And today, about 1 in 10 Americans are mainline Protestant. Okay? So in the 1950s, it was half. Today, it's 10%. The death of polite religion is right there in that graph. I call the mainline. Yeah?
Could you just give us, identify what would be included in mainline?
Oh, yeah. United Methodists, Evangelical Lutherans, Presbyterian Church USA, American Baptist Church, Disciples of Christ, the Episcopal Church, and what am I missing? UCC, that's right, United Church of Christ. Yeah, so that's, we call those the seven sisters of the mainline. And they used to be just humongous denominations. I'll show you a membership graph later on that shows you like actual numbers of like what the membership decline looked like. But I mean, guys, I don't think, if you look back like in the 1940s and 50s, that was, United Methodist pastors, UCC pastors used to dominate the conversation religiously, politically, culturally, right? They had the ear of the White House. And now, I don't even know the last time a mainline pastor's been to the White House. I mean, it's just a complete change in culture and tone and mood, and not for the better in my estimation, which I'm going to show you later on. And a lot of these denominations are in real, real trouble, including ABC USA, by the way, which is my denomination. Catholics. My wife's Catholic. Both my kids were baptized and confirmed Catholic. I go to the Catholic Church sometimes. I like Catholics. I really do. I could not become Catholic because they don't preach, and I like to preach. And I also am married, and they don't like that. So I'm going to be a Baptist for the rest of my life. I also don't have any real theological training, which doesn't work well with it. Or you guys, by the way. But God bless Baptists. I'm just locally, they're just like, hey, you want to be the pastor? And I'm like, sure. And like, okay, you're the pastor. Just like that. No one asked permission. The Catholic Church is doing okay numerically. Okay, that's the best way I would describe it. Okay numerically. They are declining a little bit, but it's slowly, slowly, slowly. Okay, you don't see that like with the evangelical graph, like, woo, you don't see that. You don't see like the main line straight down. It's just pretty much flat. So the share was about 25% in 1980, and today it's about 23%. So, you know, I mean, that's okay. I'll show you a graph later. There are 60 million Catholics in America still the largest religious tradition, you know. So that's okay. You know, like the Catholic Church is not really in any sort of real peril, except if I show you this graph, which is the share of people who attend religious services once a week. They, by the way, my Catholic friends love this graph. They do not like this graph. But I'm like, I have to just be honest with you. You know, like I got to tell you what's going on here. So this is just the trend line for the share of each tradition that's attending services nearly every week or more, going back to 1972. And, you know, look with evangelicals. If evangelicals are actually more likely to be weekly attenders today than they were in 1972. So the ones who are there are actually more devout than the ones who were there in 1972. Evangelicalism has become more devout over time, not less. And the Black Protestant Church is up a little bit, and even the mainline is never... We were never that high to begin with. I know you're shocked by that, right? About 30% of mainliners were weekly attenders in 1972, and it's about 30% today, right? So... the way you describe this, by the way, mathematically, is the denominator got smaller, right? And the numerators stayed the same or got larger, and that's why that number kind of stays steady over time. The problem, though, is obviously this blue line right here. In 1972, about half of all Catholics reported attending Mass nearly every week. Today, it's about 25% of Catholics attend Mass every week. Now, I think what's going on here is Catholicism is a cultural identity as much as it is a religious identity now. You guys get what I'm saying? Like, there's no one who's like, I'm culturally Baptist. Like, no one says that, right? You guys, you say, though, I'm culturally Catholic because my family's Irish or Italian or Hispanic, right? And so you might retain the Catholic label because of that heritage, that genetic thing, but you don't go to church anymore. So you don't. It's stickier, is what how I describe it. The Catholicism thing. A lot of Protestants stop going to church. You know what they say on surveys? I'm not Protestant anymore. Catholics stop going to church. They go, I'm still Catholic. You know, even though I haven't been to Mass in 5 years or 10 years or whatever. So I think what's happening is the number has not gone down because of that stickiness. But the mass attendance has gone down. So, you know, you look under the hood a little bit and go, ooh, that's not good. You know, so the ones who are left are not that attached to the tradition anymore. So you got to take the Catholic with a big grain of salt because probably two-thirds of them go to Mass less than once a year now. And that's a lot numerically. So, okay, here we go. This is... this is from denominational records. God, I love the main line because they're so good about numbers. You know? They love to count things, and I like people who like to count things. So what they do is they release these denominational records almost every year. But I will say what's sad is a lot of these denominations have gotten smaller. They cut their data department, and I'm like, no, that's my people. But they still report their membership numbers. So... I just picked an arbitrary point where I could find data as far back as every denomination reported, which is 1987, and then 2021. Some denominations have not reported the last year or two, so that's why it's not there. So this number is the percentage decline in membership from that 87 number down to that 2021 number. Okay. Now, I will say this, the ABC number is wrong. I know that for a fact, because I had a conversation with their person. And some person in the Midwest incorrectly entered the number of members they had in their region. They added 90,000 that didn't exist, and it messed the whole trajectory up. I was like, could you fix that, please? Like, it changes everything for me. So they're actually down about 30%. Which, there's a great mythological story there about how one person could just enter a number wrong and throw off everything. So they're really down about 30%. That's the actual number, as far as we can tell. But, like, Disciples of Christ is down 75% since 1987. Yeah. And by the way, the scales are all different because they have to be, because every denomination has, like, a lot more or a lot fewer people, so keep that in mind, too. The number of members of DOC churches now are about 300,000 nationwide, which is, I mean, at some point, you're just a large mega church. You know, you're not even a denomination in any functional sense at that point. So, ELCA... you guys were kind of I call this like the roller coaster. Like you hit the peak, you know, the chain stops, and you're sitting there at the top. For all, it's like, woo, here we go. And the ELC now is 43% down from 1987. And almost all that decline has happened since about 1998 or so. So,
yeah, I'm sorry.
1998 to today is where almost all that decline is in the ELCA. So it's actually not 87. You can move their timeline up. And you can see here, what's amazing to me about this is how the numbers are so consistently consistent. You know what I mean? Like they're just going every year. It's like 2%, 3% decline every single year. Click, 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 click. Like some of them are a little, like they go up and down. The ELCA is just constantly down at this point. PCUSA, Presbyterian Church USA, down 60%. They had 3.1 million members at one point. Now they have 1.1 million members. Like it's bad, guys. Like this is not good. The Episcopal Church. I love to use the Episcopal Church because they make their data so easily accessible. On an average Sunday in America, about 375,000 Episcopalians go to church nationwide. 375,000. That's a problem. Interestingly enough. The amount of money they collect and plate and pledge is actually up over the last 10 years. So the people have gone down. The plate and pledge has gone up. So that's a big problem. The main line that we can talk about later is the money part. A lot of these denominations are sitting on huge pots of endowments and monies and things like this. Listen, my church were closed down 10 years ago. We didn't have endowment. We were loaning ourselves money from the Wills and Bequests Fund to the general fund just to pay the bills. Loaning because we had the lawyer supposed to, because it wasn't supposed to be for general fund, But we're like, who's going to sue us? You know, like if the church doesn't exist, what are they going to say? And we would have closed down, you know, because we loan ourselves $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 every, and the money eventually runs out. And actually what's going to close us is not the money as much as it is, it's hard to come to church when there's seven people there. You know, like that hurts. That feels different. It's hard to stay motivated for a guy like me to get up on Sunday morning, you know what I mean, and go preach to six people, seven people. And two of them fall asleep. I'm tired too, you know. I'd fall asleep if I could, but I can't. United Church of Christ is down. Now there's about three-quarters of a million members in United Church of Christ nationwide. And then the United Methodist Church, I can tell you right now that graph is completely wrong because... You guys all know this. The UMC has had the largest denominational schism in American history, as far as I can tell. They lost, in an 18-month period of time, they lost 25% of their churches and 25% of their members. And we haven't even seen the later fallout from that thing. A lot of churches left the UMC, and now a lot of them are joining what's called the Global Methodist Church, which is a more conservative denomination over the issue of same-sex marriage. Not only that issue, but a bunch of issues. But that's the tip of the spear, really. And so their numbers might be down to 4.5 million now. So they might go from 9 million to 4.5 million between 1987 and 2023. So they're going to be cut in half. Think about it, that's 4.5 million people, guys. Like that's a lot of people. So this is the reality. Whatever ELCA is facing is not just what ELCA is facing. It's what every Seven Sister of the Mainline is facing, just in different degrees. And I also think that the floor is further away for some denominations than other ones, but I think like the DOC is close to having to make some tough choices now. I think the Episcopal Church is in the same boat. These are not easy things to do, and I would not be surprised at all if there are not seven sisters in 20 years. If there's six or five, because they either consolidate or merge or do something to kind of change their composition. This is really what the bigger scary thing is. Somebody asked me, hey, could you like look at like the something about the Young Main Line? I said, oh yeah, certainly look. So I pulled my data set out, the General Social Survey, and I look and I go, oh, I can't give you that data. They go, why? Because there's not enough people in the sample. This is mainline Protestants through the ages of 18 and 35. Okay, so young mainline Protestants. In the early days of the survey, there about 10% of the sample was 18 to 35 year old mainline Protestant. Today, about 1.5% of all American adults are mainline Protestant, the ages of 18 and 35. That's bad. Really, really bad. Because that's what the future of the church looks like, and there's just no one to step in, right? I mean, we'll talk about this as we go along, but actuarially, guys, a lot of these mainline churches are not long for this world just because of, you know, people are going to die, okay? Let's just put that out there. And who are they going to hand the baton to? You know, who's next? And the answer in the data is no one, or almost no one. Like, you know, last one out, turn off the lights. That's kind of how I feel in ABC USA a lot of times. Like, as soon as everyone heard that my church is going to close down, you know what the next three phone calls I got were? I got a church for you. Like, it's like sharks swim, like circling me at this point, because they're so desperate for a pastor. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. They go, we don't care. We just need a pastor for a church. You know, that's because there's no one to hand the baton to in a lot of these denominations. And I have seminary numbers. Not good. There's just not a lot of seminarians in a lot of mainline denominations now either. So it's how are you going to staff? Even if you could, how would you staff? You know? Let's just put a real fine point on this. The Presbyterian Church USA releases age distribution statistics for they break it down like it's grade. They have, look at this. So the bottom two categories are kindergarten through eighth grade. They have about 65,000 people in their churches between the ages of kindergarten and eighth grade. In comparison, they have 300,000 people who have seen their 70th birthday. You don't want the distribution to look like this. You want to have a lot of young people, and they just don't have a lot of young people. I mean, there's just no other way to slice it. You talk about 550,000 have seen their 56th birthday. This is not a sustainable future. You know, the way society changes is called generational replacement, which is just basically people die and people become adults. That happens every day. I know it's like Tucker goes on whatever his thing, talking about, like, the immigrants are replacing us. Well, we're being replaced all the time, like, by death and new birth. That's just how life goes. And that's how religion changes over time, is people die and are replaced by younger people. Well, a lot of these denominations have died because there's been more funerals than baptisms and births. It's really that simple. And what's insidious about that is it happens so slowly that you obviously don't notice most of the time. You know, it's just like, it's drips and drabs and drips and, it's like the boiling frog analogy, right? The temperature gets turned up, and all of a sudden you look around and go, how do we only got 8 people here? How'd that happen? You know, like my church, when I started my church in 2006, we had 50, and now we have 8. And I look back and go, how'd that happen? Well, if you math that out, in 17 years, I've lost about 40 people in 17 years, which means every 6 months I've lost one person. That doesn't seem like a lot, does it? Well, if you add that up over 17 years, it ends up being 8 people left. That's how this is going to change. And it's going to happen very rapidly, too, because demographically, 70-year-old people don't have a long lifespan left. And this is the same distribution for the PCUSA. 32% are 70 years old or older. 26% have seen their 55th birthday. And only 4% of the PCUSA is between the ages of 0 and 17. So even if you just kept everyone here on this graph, you're going to lose 28% of your membership in the next 20 years just through death. So that 1.1 million is going to become 600,000 just because of the funeral home. So just for them to stay at 1.1 million, you know what they do? They have to find a way to replace that 28% that's going to die in the next 20 years. Just to stay at 1.1 million, not to grow. And that's assuming that everyone here on the bottom of the graph won't leave. You see what we're up against here? Like, it happens slowly than all at once. Well, the all at once is going to happen in the next 20 years, and it's going to be catastrophic for a lot of churches, especially churches like 125 people. Well, guess what? They might be 60 people in 10 years. They might be 30 people in 20 years, and that's just the statistical reality of what's facing the mainline. Here's what I was talking about the Episcopalians. The Episcopalians are losing for a long period of time. Like before COVID, they'd lose between 2-3% attendance every year. And then it kind of accelerated in 2018. And then they went down big time because of COVID, obviously, 11%. And then in 2021, they lost 40%. They're down to 293,000. And then this is what I was telling you about. In 2022, their attendance now is 373,000 nationwide. 373,000 nationwide. And that's not very many. You know, a lot of churches can't keep the doors open with 300. So think about this. 2009, 725K. 2022, 373K. They basically lost half of their attenders in just the last 15 years. So half that again in the next 15 years, and now you're down to 200,000 people. You know, you're going to go from 725,000 to 200,000 in a period of about 30 years. I mean, it doesn't work that way. You know, that's just not how math maths. And so, just to get a little more granular on the Episcopalians, so mathematically what I try to figure out here is what happened after COVID. You know, like people ask me, like, oh, is the church coming back? Is it still, you know, what's going on here? So what I did was the straight line you see is me shooting a trend line through the data through 2019 and trying to figure out what 2022 would look like if COVID never happened. Okay? So, like, for instance, you look at baptisms, they're actually up above the trend line, but I think that's just the backlog of baptisms that didn't happen during COVID. That seems pretty logical to me. But look at burials. They're right on the trend line, right? So, I mean, that is not changing. It's going downward still and right on par. The confirmation number, look, that's the 2022 number. It's exactly where it should have been if COVID never happened. So did COVID accelerate the decline of the Episcopal Church? No. But did it slow it down? No. That's to me, like, I get asked that question a lot less now than I used to, thank God, because the answer's really boring. You know what COVID did to American religion? Nothing. The trend lines that already existed before COVID are just continuing after COVID. Like, we're back to where we would have been if we did not have that 3 or 4 year period. And you look at marriages, oh, it's up just a little bit, but the Episcopal Church is doing about 5,000 marriages a year now. Guys, look how many burials they're doing. Look how many baptisms they're doing. Look how many marriages they're doing. I mean, I always tell pastors, they go, how do I figure out my church is doing well? I go, how many funerals did you do last year, and how many baptisms did you do? Pretty simple numbers. Add them together, see what you get. And if that burial number is a lot higher than your baptism number, you're in trouble. Like, that's just as simple as it can be. And a lot of these denominations are struggling with, they're doing 25,000 burials a year. And they're doing 12,000 confirmations. So for every one confirmation, that's two burials. That's not the way you want things to go. So now let's go dance in the grave with somebody else for a while, not us. That makes us feel a lot better. So this is Southern Baptist Convention. I grew up Southern Baptist. It's amazing. I still to this day cannot wrap my head around how fast the SBC grew during the post-war period. Like, it's really staggering to look back at the data. And so what I did is I blocked it. Every time they added a million people, that's a different line here. So you kind of see how fast they were growing. Like, in the late 1940s, early 1950s is when, like, it just, like, was like jet fuel for the SBC. It was the baby boom, right? People come back from the war, and they were having a bunch of babies. And they were adding a million members every 4 years for a long period of time. Think about that. 250,000 new Southern Baptists every year for 30 years. 5,000 new Southern Baptists a week. That's a lot of people, okay? And it's fun. Man, it'd be so fun to be like the leader of the SBC in like 1962. You're like, how many we had last year? You know, 320,000. Like, that's more than the Episcopal Church has now. You know, just like every year, it's like just victory upon victory and success upon success. And what are we going to do with all this money? You know, like, how are we going to, you know, staff up and minister and all these things? And how are we going to build out all this infrastructure and all? And you can see, like, just boom, boom, you know, growing. And then you see, like, now it goes from being 4 or 5 years to being 5 or 6 years. See, the lines start getting a little farther apart. You're adding a million. You're still adding a million, but it's just taking a lot longer. And look here, 4 to 14 million, 15 million. Look, 15 million to 16 million. That took a long time. That's unfortunate. And then you see here that this, the numerical peak of the SBC is that dot right there, which is 2006, okay? In 2006, the Southern Baptist Convention reported 16.2 million members. 16.2 million, okay? There will never, you can put me on record on this, there will never be a denomination ever in American history that was 16.2 million members ever again, okay? That is just, that's unbelievable considering what's happened in America. 16.2 million. And then what happens is, it's like a roller coaster. You get the click, click, click with the chain, you know, takes you to the top, and you sit there for a minute and you don't hear anything. And they sat there for a while. Like, that 16.2 million was like, oh, you know, we added 10,000 last year. And then we lost 20,000. It's like, oh, okay, fine, we're hanging out. And then it's just like, when you get over you get past that little spot, it's just like, whoa. And that's what's happened to the SBC. In the last 15, 16 years or so, especially in the last couple years, the SBC has gone into a tremendous decline that makes what's going on in the mainline look like pocket change. They are losing members now faster than any mainline, besides the United Methodists with their schism, obviously, but any mainline church has ever thought about doing. And how many is that? It's this many. This is the change in membership. So obviously, this is the last year of gains they ever had, which was 2006. They added 36,000 members. But then the year after, they lost 39,000. So they gave back all those gains the next year. And you can see for a while, the losses were pretty minuscule. You know, 35, 40,000, 60,000. But then they start piling up, right? And then look at the last 3 years. In 2020... the SBC reported a net loss of 435,000. In 2021, they reported a net loss of 410,000. And in 2022, they reported a net loss of 457,000. Quick math tells me they've lost 1.3 million members in the last 3 years alone. That's larger than the entire membership of many mainline denominations, including Disciples of Christ, the Episcopal Church, the Presbyterian Church USA. So when we talk about decline, it's not just the main line that's declining. The Southern Baptist Convention's gone through and continuing to go through this tremendous numerical decline that only looks small because they started so big. You know, like, can you imagine the news story? Denomination loses 1.4 million members in the last 3 years. Like, that's the number. But we all go, oh, it's only like 8% because they started at 16.2 million. Right, so it doesn't feel so bad. But numerically, they're losing a tremendous amount of people, too. And they tell me, they go, oh, we're just cleaning up the roles. And I go, that's true. And I know that's not true, by the way, because they report the number of people will actually attend. So if they were cleaning up the roles and kicking off inactive members, the number of the share who are attending every week would go up, right, because the denominator goes down. But the numerator stays the same. Guess what? The share is continuing to go down of weekly attenders. So they're not cleaning up the rolls yet. Like, this is, that's eyewash. That's just PR spin from where I come from. And I'll call anybody out who tries to tell me stuff that I know is numerically false. And the new numbers are going to come out next month, by the way, and they're not going to be good. From the people I talk to, they're going to be just as bad this year as they were last year. Yeah.
So what is the real attribution on this, then, if that's not the real story? You have a theory?
Yeah, I'm going to talk about it in a second.
Yeah, I've got a theory. So, now, can I give you some good news before I give you the theory why I think this is happening? Yay, some good news. There are some denominations that are growing, but there are not many of them. I will point them out to you. Okay? The Assemblies of God. You guys are aware of the Assemblies of God?
Yes.
About 3.1, 3.2 million people, okay? They've grown 166% since 1977. They're still growing. Actually, they grew last year. Now, I will say this, though. The Assemblies of God, their growth rate went from 3% a year to 1% a year. So they're growing, but a lot slower than they used to grow. And that's actually trending towards the negative. So if you extrapolate that trend line out, they actually might start declining in the next 5 or 10 years. Assemblies are interesting because in some ways they're very evangelical. They're very conservative politically. They're actually more conservative politically than the Southern Baptists are, interestingly enough. Theologically, they're conservative, charismatic. But they also have female pastors and have for decades now. So the SBC goes, we've got, you know, they're having this big fight about women pastors right now, the SBC is. And they go, that's the reason we're declining. I go, the Assemblies of God's had a female pastor for 50 years and they're growing and you're not. So what's the answer? You know, like, it doesn't fit into these neat boxes of, like, well, if our church does this, we're, you know, I wrote a whole piece, like, oh, it's only the liberal churches are declining. I'm like, have you looked at the Southern Baptist Convention? Like, that's just a nonsense theory. Like, it doesn't track. So, Assemblies of God is up 166%. The PCA, anybody ever heard of the PCA before? Presbyterian Church of America. Like, three people, like, I know them. Their most famous pastor was Tim Keller, who just passed away in the last 12 months. They have grown 460%, but knows what the scale is on the left side? About 360,000 PCA members in America. Like, I love when people email me and go, oh, my church is growing. I go, okay, cool, how big's your denomination? 165,000. You realize the SBC lost 450,000 last year? You understand what I'm saying here? So, like, they're growing, but it's like, you're not offsetting the loss from all the other stuff. It's still net loss. Because these denominations, and the Anglican Church North America, ACNA, which is the more conservative breakoff from the Episcopal Church, is growing as well, but they're still under 400,000 themselves. They're the only denomination that's growing, that's above a million people, is the Assemblies of God. That's the only one that I know of that I can consistently track over time. And the Assemblies are growing, I think, because they're racially diverse. They've really leaned into diversity really hard. It's one of the problems that the mainline obviously struggles with, but the Southern Baptists struggle with too. They're almost over. They're like 85% white, 90% white. So that's a problem. Okay, so who else is growing? Well, the two biggest stories in American religion, one's the rise of the nuns. I might have written a book about that or two. You might want to go buy that. I looked at Barnes & Noble last night. They did not have a copy of my book.
What?
I know. They had a lot of copies of books I disagree with, but it's neither here nor there. I was texting my buddy. I go, man, this walking through the Christian section of just bums me out, man. I'm like, this is what people buy now? Like, this is what we're doing? They had a good section of C.S. Lewis, which made me happy. I was like, okay, buy these books. Like, these are good. So, non-denominational Protestant Christianity is growing unbelievably fast. The nuns are the number one story in American religion. The number two story is the nuns. Okay? And this is a movement that we haven't thought about enough. We're not writing about enough on the social science side. I've got a book in process that kind of got hung up for a different reason about the nuns. But I think they're the future of American Christianity in lots and lots of ways. So, in 1972, about 3% of all adults said they were non-denominational. And today, it's about 15% of all American adults say they're non-denominational. If you look at like the Protestant families over the last 15 years, so Lutheran, Presbyterian, Baptist, they're all declining. The only one that's not declining is non-denominational. It's really the only significant growth area. And I will say this, I do think a lot of these churches have some overlap with the Assemblies of God, which we just talked about, because the charismatic piece, the kind of the Pentecostal angle is what type of Christianity is growing in America and across the world right now, is the more charismatic worship style. Yeah?
I know there's a thing with Mormons, but what is the Mormon church? Did that ever come into?
So Latter-day Saints are interesting because they will tell you they're growing, but then you go online and they say, oh, they're declining. The problem with Mormon statistics, and I'm going to BYU in 2 months, is it's almost impossible to leave the Latter-day Saints. So here's what it takes to leave a Latter-day Saint congregation. You have to write a letter to the church that has to be notarized and sent by a certified mail to Salt Lake City to remove yourself from the roles of the Latter-day Saints. So that's an interesting thing about LDS is whenever you put money in the plate of an LDS church, it goes immediately to Salt Lake, and then it comes back down to the local church, which is an interesting model. And that's all I'm going to say about that. I have a lot of friends in the LDS, and I'm working on projects with them. They also have a social science unit. Like, the people, they just have statisticians who work for them. They release none of their statistics, which drives me absolutely crazy. Because, like, what are you hiding? Let me see what's going on there. So, non-denoms are now 15-ish% of American adults, up from 3%. These are the 20 largest religious traditions in the United States. This is based on what's called the religion census, which is not a survey. It's actually where a bunch of scholars contact a bunch of denominations and just ask to hand over their records. So that's why these numbers kind of differ from other records I've seen. The Catholic Church is the largest one. Obviously, we talked about that, 62 million Catholics in America today. But remember, probably about 25% of them are going to go to Mass this Sunday. So 15-ish million, maybe, of that 60 million or so will be in Mass in a country of 340 million people. So even then, think about the numbers numerically, how many people that is. That's probably about 4% of Americans are Mass going Catholics. So we talk about how dominant any church is. Keep that in mind. Non-denominationals are 21 million. I can tell you without a shadow of a doubt that's an undercount. Because how do you count that? You know what I mean? Like that. There's no central office. You don't have to call the non-denom office and be like, hey, that doesn't happen that way. I got one during COVID. Once I had a reporter call me and go, "How many churches closed during COVID?" How in the world would I know that? You realize how hard of a methodological problem that is? You know what a lot of churches do to close? They turn the lights off and stop meeting. Like that's it. Like you don't have to report it to anybody. Like the IRS doesn't even care. There's no central reporting body, and so that's why I think this is an undercount. Right? But I will say this, to go off on a little tangent just for a second on non-denoms. So I think a lot of non-denoms will actually become like pseudo-denominations in some ways. So there's what are called church planting networks in America now. One's called Acts 29. One is called ARC, which I think is really successful, called the Association of Related Churches. So the way it works, it's almost like a startup fund where you go to a training session and they basically vet you to see if you'd be a good pastor for them or not. And your wife has to go too, obviously. That's a joke, because why would your wife have to go to anything about your job? And here we are. God bless the evangelicals. They want your wife to play piano and wear a dress and teach Sunday school. If she doesn't, she doesn't belong. So what they'll do is they'll basically vet you and take you through a training process. And if they think you're qualified, they'll actually give you seed money to start a church. And then they'll seed you for 3 years for operating expenses. It goes down every other percentage they give you. And then it was almost like a startup, right? You start a company, you get venture capital, and then you start up, and then you get big enough to fly, and they stop funding you, and then you are not required, but strongly encouraged to give a percentage of your offering after that point back to ARC, which then goes out and funds the new church planting. You guys get what I'm saying here? It's like a, almost like a venture capital fund in some ways, but the problem is you got to hold to their doctrinal statements. And a lot of these are conservative evangelicals, so you can't have female pastors. Imagine you're trying to plant a church in, I don't know, downtown Philadelphia, and you don't have female pastors, and you're not gay friendly. So a lot of these churches are like, wait a minute, if I stick to my doctrinal statement, I can't grow, but if I don't grow, then in 2 years the money's gone. It puts them in this terrible situation of how do we meet all those requirements? So when I say they're non-denominational, I kind of like in the back of my mind, go, yeah, but they're kind of denominational in a weird way. Like, not in the traditional way, but in this new way. And a lot of those pastors will have to go to ARC trainings once or twice a year. So it's almost like a pseudo-denomination without all the structure of a denomination. So when I say non-denominational, like, there's always that undercurrent of, not really, though. Just not as denominational as, like, you know, the Lutherans are, for instance. Southern Baptists are second. United Methodists, obviously that number is completely wrong. The LDS, we just talked about that. I know that number's inflated for a fact, but here we are. Do you know there are more Latter-day Saints in the world outside the United States than inside the United States? Fun fact, 60% of Latter-day Saints do not live in the United States.
I don't want you going to BYU, but we can talk about it later.
Okay, quietly, on the side. I love my Mormon friends. They keep, you know what's really great about the Mormons? They keep really good ancestral records.
And they scrapbook beautifully.
They do scrapbook. And they make good funeral potatoes.
Yes. And they have great tea.
They do, really. You can't drink caffeine though. And they do a lot of MLMs out in Utah and a lot of YouTube channels. Did you guys know that? Like that, they're at the epicenter for both because they're really entrepreneurial and they have really good networks. I find it, from a sociological perspective, I find the LDS the most fascinating group in America. Like, they're just, everything about them blows me away. They're also incredibly white, but that's a different story. Muslims. How many Muslims are there in America? 4.5 million-ish? Not as many as you would have guessed, right? Like, someone on Twitter is like, those Muslims are taking over America. I'm like, do you not know the numbers? Do you know the state with the highest percentage of Muslims is actually Illinois, and it's 4%. 4%. Most states are 1% or less. I think like 5 states have more than 3%. So like this whole idea of like Muslims are taking over America, it's like you look at the data and go, I don't see, like there's all this discussion, oh, Biden's going to lose the Muslim vote in Michigan, it's going to call. I'm like, you realize there might be 100,000 Muslim voters in Michigan right now? Like the numbers just don't math. Like what I always say about the LDS is, you know, there's a Real Housewives of Salt Lake City, Utah, that Bravo show. Do you know how many what the population of Salt Lake City is? 200,000. Tulsa, Oklahoma is twice the size of Salt Lake City, Utah. And yet there's no Real Housewives of Tulsa, Oklahoma, is there? You see my point? We're fascinated by these like different non-us groups. And I think that's why the Mormons take up this large space in our head. But you go down the list and you see like, okay, so here's, we're down here at the bottom. Right? Evangelical Lutherans, good job. You're closer to the top. But like Jehovah's Witnesses in there. But then you see a lot of black churches in there, like National Missionary Baptist Convention, that's a black church. Missouri Synod. Hey, you guys got more than the Missouri Synod. 1.8 million. Episcopals, National Baptist, Church of Christ, Seventh-day Adventist. Now, what's funny, it's really hard to count some of these groups, by the way, because a lot of Jewish groups refuse to be counted. I think it's against their religion to be counted. So, like, it's impossible to count. You know Hasidic Jews? You guys know those people that wear, like, the hats on in New York City? We don't know how many there are because they refuse to be counted. It's against their religion to be counted. So, imagine from my perspective how hard that job is. Like, how many are you? Don't know. Can we count you? Absolutely not. You know, like, so a lot of these numbers, you got to, like, they're fuzzy. Right, it's really, really hard to count people anyway, let alone groups who are actively resisting your attempts to count them. So understand that these numbers are not like the actual numbers. It's just our best guesses about these numbers. And then we've got the nuns. In 1972, 5% of all American adults were non-religious. In 1968, there was this really funny paper I just read. This guy, Glenn Vernon, wrote it. He called the nuns the neglected category. By the way, he's calling them the nuns in 1968. So this is not my word. It's been around for 50-some-odd years now at this point. N-O-N-E-S. I have to say it. I've spelled that like three times a day. The ladies in the hats? No, not the ladies in the hats. The nuns. Nuns. 5% of Americans were nuns in 1972. By 1991 or so, it was about 6 or 7%. So like in a 20-year stretch, it went from 5% to maybe 6 or 7%. Not really statistically significant change in a 20-year stretch between the 70s and the 90s. And then from 1991 onward, it was like hockey stick growth for the nuns. And then every year or so, they grow a point or two. So you kind of see just consistently. So by 2000, they were 14% of the population. By 2014, they were 20%. The estimate is 28% in 2021, and actually the number goes down in 2022, but I don't think that's real. I think it can't continue that way. What I tell people is about 30% of all Americans are nuns now, and that's an aggregate from about 5 or 6 different surveys. So about 3 in 10 adult Americans are nuns today. That's up from 5% in 1972, so a sixfold increase. I say this as least hyperbolic as I possibly can. I think this is the largest cultural shift in American history, and it's affecting every aspect of American life. So politically, culturally, societally, in every possible way, it's changing who we are, what we are, how we think, what we do, all those things. And we don't even have our arms around this problem yet. Two months ago, I was in D.C., in a room with a bunch of the House Democrats, like Nancy Pelosi was in the room and Steny Hoyer and stuff, and I was showing these numbers, and they just cannot grasp the fact that they're a bunch of old white Catholics. You know what I mean? Like, their constituents and them don't look at all the same. They're dinos of what America looked like in 1955, not what America looks like in 2023. There's such a disconnect, so 45% of all of Biden's votes in 2020 came from atheists, agnostics, and nothing in particulars. So 45% of the Democratic coalition now are non-religious, and yet almost none of the Democrats are non-religious at the electoral level. It's just such a huge disconnect between what's happening on the ground and what's happening in Washington, D.C., and I'm like, you guys don't even know! And they're still talking about, how do we recruit the white Catholic? But I'm like, get out of here with that! That's not what you do! But, if you're Nancy Pelosi and you've been campaigning for 30 years courting a certain kind of voter, how do you not, how do you switch gears? She's 82 years old, for goodness sake. She's not going to change. So I think, to me, that's the bigger shift you're going to see in the next 10 or 15, 20 years is these older Democrats are going to die off, and who's going to be the next wave of the Democratic Party, because they need to look a whole lot more like that to reflect their constituency. And they're not right now. So I think we're in this weird, transitional period from what we were to what we will be, and we're just not there yet because a lot of people in Washington probably should retire. Thank you. So brave, so courageous. I know. I'm going to run for office. I'm going to run for president. I've got 2 positions. Are you ready for them? 1, mandatory retirement age for all members of Congress, 70 years old. You've got to retire. Go home to the farm. Have a good life. God bless you. And the complete and total ending of daylight savings time from now on forever. I will win. I will win. I will pass both pieces of legislation. I will retire, and then I will put my face on Mount Rushmore and ride off into the sunset as the most popular president in American history. Do I have positions on gay marriage? Absolutely not. Let's talk about daylight savings time. How do you feel about taxes? I feel like you're over 7 years old. You shouldn't be here right now. Go retire. That's it. That's my position. And guess what? I would win. I look at the polls every day, and that's what wins. Every year, daylight savings times come, and I just shake my fist at Congress. You know what I'm talking about. Especially when you have little kids. For little kids, they don't know daylight savings time. They don't know what time it is. They don't know where they are half the time. They get up at 5 o'clock in the morning, and you don't want to be up 5, but it's 6 o'clock. No, it's not, son. It's 5. It always happens on a Sunday, which is anti-religious, if you ask me. Why does Congress hate church? I'm getting fired up right now. Write this down. This is gonna go on my platform. I'm gonna get an infomercial. I'm gonna pay all my money on my campaign infomercial the day before we vote, and that's all it is. Me ranting for 5 minutes about how my daylight saving time is awful. That's it. So this is speaking of how we're changing rapidly. So when you saw that blip in the last number where the number of nuns goes down just a little bit, right, from 28 to 27, people go, oh, look, things are getting better. We're becoming more religious, less nuns. And then I show them this graph and I go, I don't think so. This is the religious composition of each generation, going back to the silent generation. So 1925 to 1945, the silent generation, the boomers are obviously past that. Gen X and millennials and Gen Z. So top number is silent generation. As you can see, lots of Protestants. 51% of silent generation Protestant and 23% are Catholic. So about three quarters of the silent generation were Christians. Okay? In comparison, 8% atheist agnostic and then 11% nothing in particular. So about 20% nuns, 75% Christians. Okay, that's a pretty good ratio. You know, that's a lot more Christians than there are nuns. But then in every successive generation, what you see is, especially the Protestant number is collapsing faster than the Catholic number. And I think that's because that stickiness thing we just talked about, right, where people are willing to shed the Protestant label more than they're willing to shed the Catholic label because they don't go to church. So it goes from 51% to 22%. Meanwhile, the Catholic number goes from 23 to 16. So a 7-point drop here, a 30-point drop there. You know, big drop. But, okay, so look at millennials, for instance. That's me. Any millennials in the room? Three or four of us! Yay! We're supposed to be taking over America at some point. Did you get the memo?
I did not.
I did not either. I'm like, I'm middle-aged now. How'd that happen? Like, people don't realize the oldest millennials were born in, like, 1978, guys. Like, they're not young. They're in their mid-40s now. 45 is halfway to death, actuarially. Okay? And by the way, Gen X. There are retired members of Gen X right now. Like, that, just to kind of calibrate your senses of like how old people are. And the oldest Gen Zs are going to celebrate their 28th birthday this year. So, you know, like, you got to think about what these generations mean. Now, these kids nowadays, like, some of these Gen Zs are not kids. They're, like, in their late 20s now. Like, that's not youngish. That youngish, I guess. So, 51%, 75%, 20%. Look at millennials, though. 28 plus 17 is 45, and then 17 plus 30 is 47. So, what I say with millennials is it's probably 1-to-1, Christians versus nuns. Okay, about 1-to-1. Can't say statistically whether there are more nuns than Christians among millennials. I think it's probably even. But look at Generation Z. 22% plus 16% gets us to 38%. And then you add 34 plus 19 and you get 53. That's 53 versus 38. And that is definitely not statistically, you know, that number's different. So what we can say without a shadow of a doubt is that Gen Z has more nuns than anything else. First generation, as far as we can tell, in American history, where the nuns clearly outnumber the Christians. That's why when I say like the share of Americans who are nuns has gone down, I go, yeah, but it's not going to go down for long. Because what's happening every day in America is people in these top two categories are meeting their heavenly reward, hopefully, and they're being replaced by people who are coming of age in Generation Z. And you get 75% Christians being replaced by 38% Christians every day. So that is how America is changing. And it's just like a slow wave that washes across the shores, right? And all of a sudden now we're a whole lot less Christian. And so when I see that dip, I look at this and go, yeah, but it's only temporary. It's not gonna last forever. It's just one weird data point. We're gonna become more nuns. There's just no doubt in my mind. The share of Americans who are... I always tell people it's not going to get above 50% in my lifetime, I think, because there's just... It's going to continue to go up. I just see... You see more and more resistance to the numbers of share of Americans who are Christians is going to stay probably around 50%. I don't think it's going to go... We're not going to be Denmark, is what I'm trying to say here, okay? God bless Denmark, but we're not going to be Denmark. We're not going to be Sweden. We're not going to be Switzerland. We're not going to be Western Europe. We're going to be more religious than they are, but I don't know by how much. We're going to be a whole lot less religious than when I was born, though. I can tell you that for a fact, because this is what the future of America looks like. So, most Americans are still Christians.
I constantly have to tell people that. Most Americans are still white.
Most Americans are still Christians. Those are just facts. I don't, you know. You can write about Muslims, that's great, but there's still a lot of white Christians in America. It's still the largest kind of group, what we think about it, but it's shrinking. Okay? So in 1972, about 90% of all Americans were Christians. Today it's about 62%-ish. But the share of Americans who are white Christians has gone from 73% to 46% during that same time period. So dropped below 50% somewhere in the last 5 years or so, I would bet. And boy, don't we feel it in a lot of ways. I think a lot of what we're seeing politically is a reaction to that right there. It's like the last gasp before you lose majority status. The white Christians have enjoyed majority status in America since the 1600s. And we will not enjoy it in the next 50 years. It's going to be a changing, you know, society. But here's something I really want to point out, though. Look, so this is the top number's gone from 90 to 62, and this number's gone from 73 to 46. But look what happened to this number.
Stayed the same.
Share of Americans who are non-white Christians or Christians of color is exactly the same percentage today as it was in 1972. So think about that for a second, okay? So when we talk about the decline of Christianity, you really need to be more specific. It's the decline of white Christianity, not the decline of Christianity. The decline of white Christianity. And that's really, there's two reasons behind that, because I use two things right there, right? White and Christian. The reason that number's declined is because the share of Americans who are white is declining, but also the share of people who are Christians is declining. So it's two things at once. See what I'm saying here? That's how demographics work. So we got to be really careful when we talk about this. It's the decline of white Christianity in America, not the decline of all Christianity in America. And in some ways, I actually think there might be a rise in non-white Christians in America in the next 10 or 15 years because of immigration, a lot of it. And a lot of people who come to this country are Christians. Actually, most of them are Christians, interestingly enough. So we don't think about that enough. Okay, so why is this happening, Bob? We're here. Maybe. This is, the question is, this is the share of people who said they had a great deal of confidence in a whole bunch of institutions. And this goes back from 1972 to 2022. And then I broke it down by generation. So blue is greatest and silent is red. And then boomers are yellow and Gen Z is green and millennials are purple. Now, I didn't put Gen Z on here because the timeline's not big enough yet, right? They're still young-ish. You notice which way the lines go? Like this is banks, Congress, education, executive branch. Basically every institution in America. See which way the lines go? Except this one. We have more trust in the military today than we had 30 years ago. Except for millennials, we hate everything. You're welcome. But I do think, and actually I think I have a really kind of neat explanation for that is, you all forgot about Vietnam, and we didn't forget about Iraq. What generation went and fought and died in the desert? Ours. And we haven't forgot that. Vietnam happened a long time ago now, 50 years, right? And we kind of forgot that over time. And I think our number's going to go back up, by the way, as we forget the war on terror and we don't send our folks overseas. But that's only up, you see. Everything else is either flat or down. We're going through a crisis of confidence in institutions. I think that is what's explaining what's happening with American religion. I don't think it's exactly about American religion. I think it's about American institutions. Yes, ma'am?
Could you just read what the institutions are?
Yeah. So banks, Congress, education, executive branch, major companies, medicine. That's scary, right?
Yeah.
Military. That's what this one is. Organized religion. I'm going to show you this one in a little closer in a second. The press. Never. It was never high to begin with, by the way. So like, let's not act like it. Like going from 20 to 10 ain't that bad. The scientific community is sort of flat-ish or something. Supreme Court. Hey, look. It's really the decline is really amongst Gen X and millennials. There. It's really flat amongst everyone above that. I think it's going to go down in the next couple of years, though, right? It's gonna, and then television has never been good to begin with. So it's really like everything. Like people go, I don't trust church. I go, no. And now you don't trust church. You don't trust anything. Like let's get clear about what this really is. It's not us specifically. It's just every institution in American life has been just decimated over the last 30 or 40 years. And as a guy who teaches political science and basically I teach political institutions as a career, that's bad. Like, institutions are what built this country and sustained us through our darkest hours, guys. Religion is an institution. Be like, you know what I really don't like? It's not a religion. It's a relationship. No, it's a religion. It's okay to call it a religion. Like, let's not, you know, we've got to like walk away from these institutional labels. I'm like, do you realize how we survived, I don't know, the Great Depression and World War II and all these conflicts we had? Institutions are what held us together. You don't got us to, FDIC. You guys know what that is? Yeah. Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. Uh-huh. The reason you can put money in a bank and it doesn't go poof, your bank goes poof, is because the government created an institution to save you. And here's the problem. I call it the offensive lineman problem. Anybody football fans here? You guys know what I mean by the offensive lineman problem? When do you hear an offensive lineman's name called on television?
Holding.
Or when he misses a block and the quarterback gets sacked. Do you ever hear like, wow, what a great block by the left guard? Never. But you know what you hear when they mess up? And guess what we hear about institutions is when they mess up? 99.99% of bureaucrats do an amazing job and you don't know it. They go to work, they try hard, they want to make the country a better place, they want to serve their constituents. You only remember the one time that they mess up. I think that's the problem. The news media doesn't report about the planes that land on time.
Yep.
You
should write the New York Times column on that.
I should, shouldn't I? They won't publish it though, I'll try. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you think the loss of confidence is deservedly so? Or there's a reason for it?
Oh, I think institutions have been corrupt since the beginning. I remember reading Plunkett of Tammany Hall in my undergrad and realizing, man, graft used to be really bad, and now it's only kind of bad. You know, like, I really think a lot of it's just perception, not reality. I really do believe that. I always say that 99.99% of pastors go to work, do their job, don't molest children, don't steal money. You know what I mean? They just try to serve the kingdom as best they can. And then you get the one idiot on TV who doesn't do that, you know, who messes up, you know?
Yep.
And now it's all pastors are child molesters. It's like, do you look at the data? Do you have any concept of what the numbers actually look like? No, because you don't hear about the good things that happen in all these institutions, not just religion, all these institutions at once. And so what I think this bigger movement, and by the way, here's the organized religion one. I broke it down by cohorts. So these are birth cohorts. So like these are people born between 1945 and 1949. So you can kind of like see when they lost their trust in American religion. And you can see like, you see where it happened between 1972 and about 1998 or so. And from that point forward, it's steady as she goes. And you can see it like most of the trust in religion was lost in that seven. You know what that was? That was Jim and Tammy Faye, by the way. Right? Like, am I making anything up right now? That was in the 70s and 80s. That's when televangelism hit its peak and religious right was really doing religious right things. And since then, it's just like, meh. Not been up, not been down, just been kind of like steady as she goes. So I really think if you want, but then we go to like younger generations, they're like, well, you know what I mean? Just down. That's a weird one because there's not a huge sample here, so I don't really look at those. But like, down. It's just down. Because I think the problem with millennials and Gen Z is, like, you almost get points for being more cynical. And, like, my 9-year-old is cynical now. I'm like, stop it right now! The world is a beautiful place. I do a whole rant with my students. I tell them, if you could be born at any point in the history of the world, when would you want to be born? My answer is right now. I really, truly believe that. If you got cancer 30 years ago, you were going to die. If you get cancer today, you probably won't, depending on what kind it is, obviously. But we've made tremendous strides. You guys know we cured hepatitis C. There's a shot for it. You don't get it anymore. They cured cystic fibrosis, guys. Cured it. Like, legit, 90% of people get cystic fibrosis. It used to be you would die by your 40th birthday. Now you can live a full life expectancy. Like, we live in a beautiful world. The number of people dying of cancer dropped by a third in the last 30 years. And everything's amazing and no one's happy. Yeah. right? Like, we gotta stop with this negativity about everything. It's like, why does someone run for office? Because they want to get rich and famous. How about they want to help people? Like, stop with this, like, assuming the worst about people. People are good. They're good. Like, you know, like, we gotta, you gotta, like, I know the news is going to be like, well, tonight the so-and-so is corrupt and stuff, but don't let that infect your mind. You know what I mean? Like, most police officers are great people. Most firefighters are great people. Most mayors and city council people really are trying to do their best. They're not trying to, you know, give you a hard time. They're really trying to do good. And I'm so sick and tired of just the lack of confidence in institutions. We got to stop that. And I think what we're seeing with American religion is, the only thing that's rising really is non-denominational is because they're anti-institutional at their very core, right? It's like, we really don't like the idea that when I put money in the plate, it goes to some unnamed office somewhere and they spend it for me. Like, at least the pastor's in the room right there. You know what I mean? If I'm a non-denom church, because it's all right there. There's nothing beyond us. It's just right here. We like that thing. But, like, I always say, like, okay, so you're cool non-denom. That's fine. If there's a tsunami in Southeast Asia, how are you going to help them? The American Baptists spent 150 years building up missionary networks all across the world, looking for people on the ground, in 24 hours in almost every country on earth because of the institutions that we built. And you have none outside your building. You know, like, you've got to think about the bigger picture. And I don't think they think about those things. I think the kingdom of God expands beyond the walls of my church, even the walls of my community, even the borders of the United States. And a lot of these non-denoms don't give the Red Cross. I go, you know, that's not the solution. Like, that's a Band-Aid solution for the real problem. And we can talk mess all we want about the SBC, but boy, they put some people on the ground in some countries and help some folks. I know that for a fact. You know? Organized religion decline is real because the confidence organized religion. So, we'll do some takeaways, and we'll do Q&A, and then we'll take a break, and we'll do some more talking. One, mainline Protestant Christianity is rapidly declining. We talked about that at length. But even some evangelical denominations are declining as well. So, I mean, it's not just one thing. I think it's all denominations are in trouble right now. Almost all. Vast majority. Number three, there's a rejection of institutional religion in favor of non-institutional religion. I think the idea of spirituality, you know what I think the idea of spirituality is? It's inherently individualistic, not communitarian. Like, I can go do yoga by myself, or I can go for a nature walk. Like, that's not what religion is. Religion ties us to other people. It's not just me and the divine, it's all of us together. Right? Like, you can't tell me that when you say the creed in a group of people, you don't feel different than when you say it by yourself. Or when you say the doxology, or say the Lord's Prayer, it doesn't change you. Because it absolutely changes me. Like, to get rid of that is to get rid of what it means to be a religious person, a spiritual person. I don't think you can find God on your own. All of human history has shown us that's not how religion works. So now our generation's like, nah, I'll do it this way. You know, like, that's what kills me. It's like, your grandparents used this to get through World War II and the Great Depression. And you're like, nah, I don't need that anymore. Like, how haughty is that, right? And now they're like, but why are we so lonely? Why are we so depressed? Like, how can you throw off 2,000 years of religious tradition and replace it with nothing and everything's better? It doesn't work that way, you know? I would say the solution for bad religion is not no religion, it's better religion. You know? And I think a lot of people got lost in the middle of that transition, right? Like, no, we just don't need religion at all. Yes, you do. So the deinstitutionalized religion is growing quickly. And number four is that the nuns are rising among everyone, especially amongst Generation Z. So younger generations are less religious than older generations. Okay. I'm sure you have no questions. Bye. Go ahead. Yeah.
Divorce come into this place?
Oh, I'm going to talk about that in part two. We're going to talk about that. Oh, yeah.
Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, so how does divorce play into this? Yeah, and in the answers, I'm going to talk about marriage and family a lot in part two, because the evidence is that being not married and no children makes you a lot less likely to show up at church. A lot less likely. And I think that's going to be really the core of this new book that's kind of making this point of, like, the path to stay in church has gotten really narrow. And it used to not be so narrow. And I think that's bad for us. for us as a religious community, but also for those people who need that help. So, yeah.
How does America compare to Europe?
How does America compare to Europe? How does America compare to Europe religiously? The answer is so there are some countries in Europe that are incredibly religious. Okay, for instance, like in the data I have, Poland, 44% of Polish people go to church every week, which is higher than any state in America. So you got one that's like even more religious than Utah, which is crazy. You know, like you think Utah is religious, but then on the bottom, you've got some of the least religious countries on earth, you know, like Sweden, Denmark, the Scandinavian countries. Like 3% of people there go to church every week. So like we're in the middle of that. Like so, the least religious states in America are like 10% of like Vermonters go to church every week. But then, you know, we got Utah where it's like 35%. So the median church attendance in America is about 25% of people go to church every week. In Europe, as a continent, it's about 14%. So we're more religious than them, but I have to you know, qualify by saying, okay, what part of Europe are you talking about? Because Italy looks a lot like us. But then Germany looks a lot less like us. You know, so it's even like variations inside, you know, like we consider like our ancestral countries. It's not all the same. You know, consider like Denmark is 3% and Italy is 25% on attendance. Like there's huge gaps, just depending on. The most religious parts of the country, or the world, are the ones you would probably think of, right? The Middle East, Southeast Asia. There's a lot of, Indonesia is the most religious country on earth right now. It's majority Muslim though, but most religious country on earth. But what you see is like religion's almost always regional. So like one country's really religious, its neighbors are almost always religious. The big, the weird outlier there is South America. There are some countries in South America that are incredibly religious, and then you go one country over, and they're incredibly irreligious. South America's got a really weird, like, usually they're all clustered by region, and in South America it's not that way. So, long answer. Yes, ma'am?
I'm just curious. You have a good view of who's here.
Yeah, a lot of gray hair.
Yeah, I just was going to ask, what do you think, I think just myself, I think we have a lot of silent generation people mm-hmm. here, mm-hmm. a lot of boomers, mm-hmm. maybe a few. I fall in Gen X. Ooh. Do we have anyone below other than you and Eric?
All right, who's the youngest person here right now? Yeah. How old are you?
27.
Oh my gosh, 27.
14.
Hey, in about 30 years, all this is yours. All of it. You get all the buildings, all the furniture, good luck. The light bill is probably going to kill you. I say that because the light bill is what killed us. Honestly, it's the light bill. $1,000 a month. And when you have a church built in 1960 with radiant floor heating, you can't turn off one section. It's either all on or all off, and it takes a while to heat up. And our insurance was like $12,000 a year too, so we had to replace our roof, which was $75,000. So, so when I look at this group, let me put my sociological hat on for a second here. The first thing I think is this is not an average Sunday because this is a Saturday morning event. So like a lot of parents are probably out with travel baseball, which is like where my wife's at right now. But I also think like you look like what a mainline church looks like.
Yeah.
I mean, I'll just be dead honest with you guys. Look, and that's scary. Just from a pure numeric perspective, that's scary. Because, you know, life expectancy, y'all know what the number is, early 80s, you know, and start thinking about that. Now, we do know that religious people tend to live longer. Statistically, that's true. But not that much longer. You know, not 120. So what does the future look like? What's the handoff look like? Who's the next generation that can carry forward? And then we also know that most donors tend to be older as well. And so not just numbers, but numbers, you know, like numbers on the balance sheet. So that's another question. That's the worry that I would have too is where's the money coming from? Because the money goes away, then a lot of problems become much more exacerbated when you can't pay for basic upkeep and maintenance. You know, here's a weird thing too, by the way, just real quick. One thing I didn't realize about losing membership is when the plumbing breaks, guess who they call now? Me. I'm not a plumber. I drywall, I plumb, I electrical. You know why? Because we used to be able to call the guy in the church who was the handyman who would come do it for free. So now that becomes my job, or we have to hire someone, so now it costs twice as much as it would because we have volunteers, right? So that's something that I didn't think about too until it got to the point where we didn't have anybody. So that's what makes that spiral, you know, get worse and go faster is because you're losing money left and right for all kinds of weird reasons that you wouldn't have lost it 20 years ago. So, Sarah.
Yeah, I work in the association world, and I also work in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things that we've been talking about relate to trauma responses.
Yeah.
And you talked about generational differences, mm-hmm. but, you know, I think sometimes we pass judgment about what a generation's approach is when really it's based on trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about how that plays a role? You referenced it a little bit when you were talking about the military, but...
Yeah. So we actually, in the Grady Church, we actually asked about that. Like, why did you leave church? And, you know, being abused from the church, something like that was one of the possible answers. We didn't get a whole lot of uptake on that. Like, not a lot of people said that it was because of trauma specifically. We actually asked people, do you think kids are more likely to be abused in church versus other environments? So, like, you know, like daycares or whatever. And the answers were really mixed on that. It's so like a third said yes, third said no.
It's interesting you jumped to that, but I was even thinking like the feeling of being excluded.
Oh.
Or feeling of being othered. Or feeling of not being welcomed. Or, I mean, all of those things are trauma that we deal with. Or like your parents required you to go to church and that wasn't something you wanted to do and you felt out of place there. That can be a trauma response as well.
I don't want to go to church as soon as I have to go because they paid me to show up. So I'll talk about this a little bit in the second half, but the problem is there used to be spaces where you could go to churches that were more welcoming to certain LGBTQ people are not welcome in a Southern Baptist church. I don't care what they tell you, right? Like, that's just a fact. The problem is there's not a lot of mainline churches around anymore that have rainbow stickers. Like, in my community, my town, my county's 40,000 people in rural Southern Illinois. There's four mainline churches, as far as I know. Ours is going to close. The Presbyterians and the Lutherans had actually joined together in the same building because they couldn't afford to be separate. So now they have, like, service at 9:30 and 10:30, something like that. And the United Methodist Church is the last, will be the last mainline church in my community in 10 years. So the problem is, like, if, let's say I grew up in a church that was Southern Baptist and I'm gay, I leave that church, should, I want to go back to church. Like, I want to find a place that makes sense to me. In a lot of parts in America, there are no churches for you that are not evangelical. And so I think that is a bigger problem is a lot of people have a spiritual need. They can't fulfill it, though.
The evangelicals don't welcome the LGBT.
That's the problem. So in rural communities, your choices are evangelical, Catholic, or none. Those are your three choices. And I think a lot of people would go to a church like this church, but not everywhere else is like Madison, Wisconsin, guys. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. Actually, I know for a fact, if you were a gay couple in my community and you want to get married in church, there's not a single church in my county that would marry you. Not a single one. So, you know what I mean? It's like how do you solve the, we're going to talk about this in a second after we do the break, but it's a, and I think it goes beyond that. I think there's all kinds of spiraling issues that come out of that problem. Because people are now lonely because they can't find a place to go because the places they go tell them they're not equal. They're worth less. And I think that's a problem. I think that religion is best when it gives you a buffet of choices, right? You can kind of find a church that meets your needs however you want them to be met. And we're not seeing that in rural America a lot. It's... Bob, we'll do one question. We got to take a break, okay?
Did you say you teach political science?
I do, yeah.
So what do you think of...
Oh, no. No! No, Bob! No! Goodbye. Bob's asking me about politics right now.
My question is, what do you think about the... We thought that politics has become our religion in this country.
Okay, I reject that statement that politics has become religion in this country because politics is irredemptive, it is not salvific, it makes you worse, not better, there is no hope and there's no joy and there's no peace in politics on the left or the right. Let me say that unequivocally without a shadow of a doubt. Anyone who searches for any of those things in politics is going to be disappointed at best, if not crushed, by what politics is.
But it seems to me our identity as a country is perhaps more of, are you Republican or Democrat versus Catholic or...
I think you're right, and I think that's one of the primary problems in America is you identify yourself first by what letter goes behind the name of the guy you vote for on election day. And we're going to talk about that in a minute, but American religion used to be incredibly politically diverse. Like, you would sit next to a Republican and Democrats on Sunday morning, and that was good. And now you don't, and that's bad.
Yeah, it feels like that's become the religion, the politics, the bad part of,
yeah.
Of the religion.
And I think we're seeing what's called the God gap or the pew gap, which is the idea of, like, the Republican Party has become the party of white Christianity, and the Democratic Party has become the party of everyone else.
Say that again.
Yeah.
The Democratic Party has become the party of everyone else, and the Republican Party has become the party of the white Christian. 75% of Republican voters today are white Christians. The Democratic Party, think about what the Democratic Party is, by the way. It's a coalition of Muslims and atheists and black Protestants and mainline Protestants and old school white Catholics. Good luck! You know, like, that's a weird coalition of people. I will say the Republican Party's problem is the people they rely on to get them on election day are dying. I just showed you, right? Share Americans and white Christians are under 46%. You can't keep winning elections when your base is literally crumbling from the bottom. The problem with the Democrats is how do you keep all those weird coalitions of voters happy? You know, like, for instance, the Equality Act. You guys have heard this, the Equality Act thing, which is the idea that you can't discriminate against people based on their sexual orientation or gender identity at any space in American society. Atheists love it, but you know who doesn't love it? Religious organizations, because what it would say to them, unless they carve it out, which they're not in discussion, but in the current bill says that churches could not fire a pastor for being trans or gay. Evangelicals would not like that. Catholics would not like that. You know those would not like that? Black Protestants would not like that. So how do you square that circle, right? Like, how do you make both groups happy at the same time? Because as soon as you carve out religion, you know what the atheists are going to say? Well, why do they get special treatment to discriminate against people? Good luck. See the problem there? There's an inherent tension in that conversation that the Democrats love to talk about but do nothing about because they know there's no winners there. Right? You're going to make a part of your coalition very upset with doing it. Well, Obamacare. Remember the birth control mandate and Obamacare and all that stuff? It almost sunk the whole thing over that one little bitty issue.